recap a little bit on what we've been doing in the last few weeks and say a little bit more, and then have a cup of tea, and then we'll come back and explore the symbolism of the Vajra. So, we're exploring symbols from Tantric Buddhism. And Tantric Buddhism is it's a sort of later phase of Buddhism, sort of around about 6th, 7th, 8th century in India. And it survived particularly today in Tibet, so Tibetan Buddhism is probably where you find Tantric Buddhism the most prevalently. The traditional word for Tantric Buddhism is Vajrayana, which is the vehicle or the way of the Vajra. So the Vajra, which we're going to be exploring later on, gives its name to this whole branch of Buddhism. And particularly, Vajrayana Buddhism is concerned about becoming enlightened, becoming a Buddha, right now in this life, in this very life. It sort of rejects, or at least it doesn't have much truck with, huge metaphysical abstractions. Buddhism did develop very complex metaphysical systems in India, and the Vajrayana sort of just kind of, in a way, was determined to sweep aside all sort of intellectualizing, all abstract sort of conceptual stuff, and say, what is your experience right now? It's in your experience right now. If you look deeply enough, right now, in this physical, embodied, experiential sense, if we look at our experience right now, enlightenment is there, potentially. The seeds of enlightenment are there in every moment of experience. If we only saw our experience with enough clarity, enough depth. And it's simply because we don't see it with clarity and depth that we don't wake up to enlightenment, that we don't become Buddhas on the spot. So Vajrayana Buddhism was concerned with a very, very practical awakening to enlightenment in the moment, and particularly practical in that it emphasized working with the body, particularly with energy in the body. It's a Buddhism that works with energy. All of our experience, you could say, I mean, the tradition probably wouldn't say this because it didn't have the same concept of energy, but you could say all of our experience, the whole of the phenomenal universe, is energy manifesting in various crystallized forms. And they're not completely crystallized in that they're not fixed. They seem to be relatively permanent, these forms. But as we look closer, the whole of the phenomenal universe is just one big cauldron of bubbling energy. That's what it is. And that includes us, and that includes this form. We are energy made manifest, energy made, as it were, into form, into physicality, as well as there's a sort of emotional, mental, psychic component to energy. Energy isn't just as science would tell us, it's not just an inert physical thing. There's also psychic energy. There's a psychic component to it. And we are that psychophysical energy made form. And there's nothing static about us. This energy is interacting all the time with the rest of the universe. And Tantric Buddhism is saying we can access this energy. Vajrayana Buddhism is saying we can access and free up this energy. In a way, it's available all the time in all things. Phenomenal amounts of energy, but we don't tap into it, we don't access it. We can access it, but what's more, we can transform it. We can transform and channel it. So, you know, 20th century physics has discovered the energy in a single atom, this explosive energy in every atom of matter in the phenomenal universe. Everything is just energy. Psychic energy is no less sort of powerful. And the Vajrayana gives us tools, methods for accessing that and transforming it, transmuting it into Buddhahood, into energy that is completely free. It's completely unfettered. A Buddha, an enlightened being, would experience a freedom of energy, an unfetteredness of energy, a sort of limitless resource of energy. It was as if they were somehow tapped into all the suns in the cosmos, at least at a psychic level. At a psychic level, physically, the Buddha would have still had human form, and as he aged, his physical body would have aged and his physical energy would have deteriorated. But the enlightened mind would have been unfettered, unconditioned by any limitations whatsoever. And we have that enlightened energy potentially burning away within us. But what we tend to do most of the time is not see it at all, and then we kind of dribble it away, worrying about me, or in your case, you, worrying about whether you can get what you want in your life, whether other people like you, whether you're going to be successful, whether you're rich enough, beautiful enough, attractive enough, whether you've got everything you want, or worrying that you haven't got any of those things. In our self-obsession, we forget who we potentially are, and the huge, the vast, unlimited energy that we can tap into. Not just tap into, but that we actually are embodiments of. So the Vajrayana is attempting to directly unleash that energy, that power. Vajrapani on the shrine is a symbol of unlimited, unleashed, enlightened energy. And he's terrifying. To our unenlightened, tiny little minds, with our self-obsessed, tiny little frames of reference, unleashed energy from the enlightened mind would be terrifying. It would be like standing in the center of the sun. It would burn us away. At least it would burn our petty-mindedness away. It would burn away egotism. And so Vajrapani appears to us as terrifying. I'll say more about him later on. And the Vajra that he holds is a symbol of this, you could say, this infinite energy, but concentrated into a form, crystallized into a completely condensed, concentrated form. So it's the energy of the cosmos held in his hand, grasped as a thunderbolt. So we'll come on to look at the Vajra and the way of the Vajra after a cup of tea. Okay, good. So, welcome back. I want to start looking at this symbol of the Vajra. First of all, by talking about two... It's a very rich symbol, but I'm going to start talking about two of its sort of aspects. The first aspect is that the Vajra is said to be like a diamond. It's said to be like a diamond. So what associations for you does a diamond have? A diamond is still a powerful symbol in our culture. And I guess it probably is for all cultures, maybe with slight variations. Let's see if we can just get into what symbolism it has for us. I suspect that for ancient Indians it had slightly different symbolism, but we'll come on to that. So anybody want to say what a diamond, what qualities, what symbols, what aspects of a diamond stand out for you, either at a symbolic level or just at a factual level, what a diamond sort of seems to be? Yeah.
Being able to cut glass.
Yeah, being able to cut glass. So why is that, why does that come to mind? Because you're right. But what?
It kind of looks similar as substances, but then one of them is so much harder.
Yes. So in a way, to tell a true diamond, to tell that it's not glass, you could use it to cut glass, perhaps, because it is so much harder, so much tougher. And that toughness, that hardness, is one of the key elements of why the Vajra is likened to a diamond, because a Vajra is said to be indestructible. Nothing can destroy the Vajra, just as at least symbolically, a diamond is the hardest of all substances that can cut through anything else but can't be destroyed itself, at least symbolically. That's probably not literally true, but a Vajra is said to be indestructible. Not literally hard, not in the sense of sort of solid hard, but indestructible energy. But yes, diamond, hardness that can cut glass, can cut through anything. Just as a Vajra is said to be able to break through anything. It's a force. I sometimes imagine it like a laser. Obviously there weren't lasers in ancient India. But imagine a laser cutting through steel. A laser is this concentrated, powerful, pure energy that can cut through the hardest solid substances just by its purity and focused energy. But it's not hard in a kind of solid sense. A laser is completely... it's just light, isn't it? So yes, diamond and hardness. Hardness is a real... What else does a diamond conjure up for you? Or the quality of a diamond. Why a diamond?
I mean, it's made out of the same element as coal.
Ah, that's interesting, isn't it? So what does that say to you?
Well, it's just like, it's the same as coal, but it's in a different form.
Yeah.
It's this beautiful object, but even though it's made from the same element as coal. Which is coal.
Yeah. It's sort of, it's just dirt and dust, as it were. Transmuted through immense pressures and heat. As a kid, actually, I was a very young, small kid. I used to try and make diamonds out of coal. I later went on to study physics and realised that you can't do it. I used to messing around with fire and would create, bonfires in bins and mix up coal and press very hard. But alchemy, the art of alchemy, I mean, I'm not saying I was an alchemist, the art of alchemy was trying to transmute substances, wasn't it? It was trying to create the philosopher's stone out of just rock and dirt. So transmutation is an important symbolism in Vajrayana Buddhism. And the Vajra has that symbolism very much at its heart, the transmutation of forces, of energy, from destructive, unhelpful manifestations of energy to enlightened energy, liberated energy. That transmutation is at the heart of the symbolism of the Vajra. And the diamond, it's great that, that speaks of that transmutation into something incredibly precious, from coal, incredibly common and just grubby, to something very, very precious and beautiful. Anything else about a diamond?
You just sort of said it, but precious.
Precious, yeah.
But I was thinking in terms of monetary value, it's precious in terms of it's like concentrated.
Mm.
Like if you're going to carry around your money bag or carry around a diamond, the diamond's worth more, it's concentrated.
Yeah, in a tiny form.
Yeah.
It's concentrated, it's precious, it's rare, it's beautiful, it's prized, it's valued. Sangharakshita in the book, the Creator Symbols of Tantric Buddhism, when he's talking about the Vajra, he starts off talking about prehistoric human beings who, you know, must have been amongst the first to discover jewels. Mine the earth and discover jewels. Certainly, you've got, you know, the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, where they discovered metal and discovered fire, and then probably at some point started to discover things like gold and jewels. And how incredible these magical these things must have seemed, to the extent where millions of years later, they still speak to us of preciousness, of worth, of beauty. Almost. I mean, we don't live in an age where things are sacred anymore, and yet, when you ask somebody to marry you, it would be with a diamond ring in this age, in our culture. It's a sort of a hollow, slightly sort of tamed manifestation of the sacred power of a jewel like a diamond. Anything else about a diamond?
They're sort of hard won, aren't they? You've got to mine for them in order to just lying around. You've got to make a tremendous effort.
Yeah, they're not just going to be offered up to you. Yeah. I mean, the earth will not yield them without effort.
Mm.
You have to dig deep. What's more, you dig into the earth, into muck, into all the grub of life. And within that you find this incredibly precious, almost sort of miraculous thing. And it's hard won. And the Vajrayana, if you want to wield the Vajra, really wield the Vajra, it'll take everything. It'll take everything. Because in the Vajrayana, remember, it's the Buddhism of symbolism. So the Vajra isn't an external thing, although it has an external manifestation. The diamond isn't an external thing. The diamond is the diamond-like radiance, the energy, the concentrated purity, the brightness, the beauty of the enlightened mind, which is our own potential mind. So it's hard won, and it's rare in the sense that most of us don't realise it. And most of us don't realise it because most of the time, and I include myself in this, I'm not quite prepared to give up everything in order to win it. I have sort of one foot in the sort of world of the Dharma, and one foot heavily planted in samsara, where I kind of just want to make sure I'm all right, thank you. And in a sense, one perhaps can't just jump headlong into the Tantra, but ultimately, if we're going to wield the force of the Vajra, if we're going to become a bearer of the Vajra, if we're going to realise our own diamond nature, then we will have to be prepared, at least, to give up everything. I don't just mean material possessions. They're easily given up in comparison to the very will to have a separate existence, the very drive to have a separate identity, a sense of me-ness, me, wanting what I want. That drive, that urge, is as rooted in us as the urge to life itself. It is that primal, and it's that primal energy that has to be unlocked from its egoistic, fettered confines into the force of enlightenment. That's what bearing a Vajra would mean, and that's what giving up everything would mean. Do you see what I mean? When we think of giving things up, I mean, I think of giving up cake, frankly, and that's a long, long way from what the Vajrayana is demanding. Not to say, I won't say more. but it's the Vajrayana is not to be messed with. It's not to be played with. I say that because in our kind of consumerist age, where we want quick results and we think we can buy anything at the press of a button online, it's very easy to even cheapen symbols from the most profound traditions. It's very easy these days to go and get tantric initiation. You probably have to just pay a few hundred pounds, and in a weekend you could be initiated into being the bearer of the Vajra, and then go back to work on Monday morning as if nothing had happened. And that is just a complete cheapening, a consumerization of something that has immense value and shouldn't be played with in that way. So yeah, a diamond is hard won. It's beautiful, it's precious, it's rare, it's hard, it's indestructible. But there's another aspect of the Vajra. It's a diamond, but it's a diamond fused with a thunderbolt. So a thunderbolt, in a way, just adds to some of this quality. You've got this indestructible energy, but now it's moving. And it can destroy, break through anything. It's the thunderbolt of Zeus. In Indian mythology, it would be the god Indra. In pre-Buddhist mythology, in sort of Hindu mythology, it's the god Indra, who's the king of the gods, who is also the god of storms. And he would wield the thunderbolt, just as Zeus did. And this thunderbolt, the energy of the thunderbolt, I guess when human beings were still in awe of nature in a way that we so easily have forgotten, lightning in the sky would have been one of the most awesome spectacles possible. There would have been this sense of being witness and dangerously close to the power of the gods of the universe itself. And then, of course, Indra was associated with storms, and that meant that he was the bringer of rain, which was also the bringer of life. So there was this indestructible force that could break through anything, and yet it was also associated with life itself, this energy that is life itself. So you've got this diamond and you've got this thunderbolt fused together, and then held by a being such as Vajrapani in his hand, and he holds it as if he's about to hurl it at you. Smash through our delusions. Smash through our egotism. It's as if he's in enlightened energy, the power, the force of in the enlightened mind, that just wants to break through all obstacles. And the primary obstacle to enlightenment is the delusion of egotism, of the delusion of a fixed and separate selfhood. And then all the craving and all the hatred that goes with that delusion. Vajrapani just smashes it. It's interesting because when Buddhism has been popularized in the West, a lot of the images that we're used to associating with Buddhism are much more gentle images, aren't they? They're the images of the lotus, of the Buddha sitting very peacefully in meditation, this beautiful, slightly enigmatic smile playing on his face. Compassion, kindness, all of those qualities are probably what come to mind when we think about Buddhism. Non-violence, for example, is at the heart of Buddhist ethics. And all of that's true, but it's not the whole story. There's a danger, and this must have been a danger throughout Buddhist history, that we associate Buddhism with niceness, with just being nice, kindness with meekness, with piety. And real compassion is not about just being pious. In fact, it's not about piety at all. It's not about niceness. Buddhists, if they're real Buddhists, aren't nice. They're not nice people. and if you think they are, that's because you don't know them well enough. You try living with them. They're not nice. Buddhists are, hopefully, they will embody, at least to some degree, kindness, metta. But it'll be metta that isn't a superficial candy floss kindness. It's a metta that's rooted in truth. It's a metta that's rooted in trying to live by the way things as they really are. And that takes energy. To realise the truth will take all of our energy. So an essential aspect of Buddhism is energy. An essential aspect of the enlightened mind is this unfettered energy. Unfettered, unleashed energy. You could say there's a wildness about it, even though it will be bent on compassionate action. It will always be bent on non-harm and on compassionate action. But there's a wildness about it in that it won't be conventionally nice. The Tantra, the Vajrayana, is anything but conventionally nice. Last week, Papa Vajra, I wasn't here, but I listened to his talk afterwards. He was talking about the Mahasiddhas, who are, you could say, the founders of the Tantra, and they weren't conventional religious people. They were wild men, living wild ways, teaching in completely unconventional ways. So Vajrapani is not a nice figure to encounter. You wouldn't want to meet him, not even on in daylight. Well, let me just describe him to you and see why you wouldn't want to meet him. He's made of this blue light, this dark blue light. All the Buddhist deities, they're not solid. They're manifestations of light. But Vajrapani's light is this mysterious dark blue. He's got a very, very powerful, huge body, huge limbs, powerful limbs. He's naked, but he's garlanded with various ornaments. On his crown, he wears a garland of five skulls, fresh skulls. Sometimes he has three bulging eyes. In this image, it's only got two. But they're fiery eyes, they're bloodshot, bulging eyes. The third one, if he has it, is in the centre of his forehead. He's garlanded with snakes. So there's all this... snakes. But he's also, in this image, he's not just completely naked, he's wearing a tiger skin. The freshly skinned pelt of a tiger wrapped round him. You can sort of see the claws and some of the blood. Often he's garlanded with ornaments of bone. He's got fangs, he's got claws, and he's surrounded by... he's wreathed in flames, in fire. He emerges out of fire. He's running towards you. He doesn't stand still. Some peaceful Buddhist images are sometimes standing. They're standing in that they're stepping down into the world with compassion. Well, Vajrapani isn't standing. He's running. He's leaping towards you out of the void. He's leaping into your consciousness, surrounded by fire. And he's wielding the Vajra, the diamond thunderbolt, which is going to smash all egotism. Not on this image, but sometimes he's trampling as he runs on some bodies. And they're the bodies of delusion and craving. And they're dead under his feet. So it's this roar that I've once or twice... encountered in meditation something, well, I've glimpsed something of Vajrapani just once or twice. Not sort of deliberately, I wouldn't try and evoke him deliberately. He sort of just emerged once or twice in meditation. And I've been in a very good state when he's emerged. I've been on solitary retreat and been meditating a lot, and there's been a lot of confidence in the Dharma and a lot of metta in my experience, and in a way that's why I've been able to bear him emerging. And in one meditation he was coming towards me. He wasn't running, he was sort of walking rather slowly towards me, but in a way that was sort of unstoppable. But what it felt like was this huge mass that I couldn't make out very clearly, this dark mass, this force that was surrounded by flames coming towards me. It was the fire that was the most prevalent. And as it came towards me, what I experienced was exhilaration. I experienced something ecstatic, like it was... it was physical exhilaration, ecstasy, and he came right towards me. I just sort of sat still, and there's this fire. I was surrounded by fire, this dark form, and then he kissed me on the lips and breathed fire into me. And it was exhilarating. It was just fantastic. I've never had it again. Even actually when I have tried evoking him, he hasn't turned up. If you are able to meet him, if you ever do meet him, there is the potential of ecstatic liberation. This energy, if you're not frightened of it, if you're not frightened of it destroying our small-mindedness, it liberates. And when it liberates, it's ecstatic. It's sort of infinite and boundless. But he holds this Vajra. Now, I've got a Vajra here. The Vajra in the Vajrayana, in Tibetan Buddhism, it became stylized, highly stylized. So it doesn't look like a diamond. It doesn't look like a thunderbolt. It looks actually... it became a sort of scepter that a royal person would hold. So if you were a tantric guru, it was like a symbol of royalty that you would hold. And I've got a small Vajra here that I'm going to, in a moment, I'm going to pass round. And you could just kind of hold it and see what you make of it. Have a look at it. And this stylized form that Vajrapani holds, that's here in bronze, is rich with symbolism itself. It's rich with every aspect of it. Means something. I'm going to say a little bit more about this form. So I'm going to start passing it round. Maybe if you go from sort of here to here and then do it in, go towards the back of the room and then maybe pass it to the front again. So, one more thing to say before I move on to describing the Vajra more closely is that although really the Vajra is a tantric symbol, it does the concept of a Vajra does appear right back in early Buddhism. In particular, you get it in relation to the Buddha's enlightenment. In the earliest text describing the Buddha's enlightenment, he sits on the Vajrasana, which is the diamond throne. And of course, Vajrasana in Suffolk, our retreat centre in Suffolk, is named after the Diamond Throne. The Diamond Throne, historically, the Buddha gained enlightenment in northern India, in Bodh Gaya, in northeastern India. And you can visit the place today. There's a site where... there's archaeological and historical evidence that it's pretty close to probably where he sat. This diamond throne, mythically, the Vajrasana, was the centre of the cosmos, the centre of the universe. And spiritually, that's true. It is the centre of the spiritual universe. Buddhist cosmology made it the centre of the whole cosmos, in not just a spiritual sense, but in a physical sense. And today it's also in Suffolk. You can go there. The Vajrasana is, as I say, in early Buddhism. Later Buddhism, the Vajrayana, picks up this notion of the Vajra and develops it into a very, very rich symbol indeed. So one of the first things to say after talking about the Diamond Thunderbolt is that the Vajra stands for, it becomes a symbol for reality itself, for reality is experienced by the enlightened mind, the transcendental nature of all things, reality of things as they really, really are. And what the Dharma, what Buddhism, what the Vajrayana says about them is that all things are shunya. If we could really see things as they are, we would see shunyata, or experience shunyata. And shunyata is usually translated as emptiness. But emptiness is a really poor word for what's been trying to be communicated. Shunyata is something more like the ineffable nature of all things, that anything, any experience in reality, nothing can be captured by concepts or words. Words or concepts can point to experience, to reality, but they can't encompass it. Reality is ineffable, it's ungraspable, it's undefinable. It's shunya. It's empty of all conceptual constructs. Yeah. So shunyata is a designation for reality itself, and the Vajra is a representation of that reality. It's shunya. It's shunyata in form. Actually, all things are shunya. All things are shunya. The Vajra is a pointer to their shunya nature, to their empty nature. So let me just pause there and see if there are any points of clarification or questions about anything I've said. I've talked about energy, I've talked about the diamond thunderbolt, this indestructible force destroying egotism, trampling on craving and delusion. Vajrapani as a symbol, as a personification of that energy, wielding a Vajra. The Vajra, as well as being the diamond thunderbolt, being a symbol for reality itself. The shunya, the empty nature of all things, if we could perceive them with the eye of enlightenment. So anything that you need unpacking a little bit more. Probably there's nothing you can say to that, is there? Go on.
You said he's not nice.
No.
What is he?
It's a bit like... he's uncompromising. He's uncompromising in his compassionate activity. So... one way of thinking about this is that when most people come along to Buddhism, they want to live, they think they know what would make them happy, and they want to be happier. And we kind of think that happiness lies in a certain direction. So what Buddhism says is, yes, you can be really happy, but as you start to practice, you realise that actually the things that you thought you wanted are not the things that are really going to fulfill. And so Buddhism doesn't offer you those things. In fact, it asks you to let them go. It strips you away, if you let it, of all the things that you initially thought you wanted. Yes? Buddhism says that there is a fulfillment to be found in life. There is your own Vajra nature. But it will only be revealed if you strip away everything, if you strip away all desire, all hatred, if you transmute it all into a force that even strips away this notion of me itself. To do that, it's not a comfortable journey. Buddhism isn't a palliative. It won't give you what you want. A lot of the time, what I want is a cosy, comfortable time. Thank you very much. Buddhism doesn't offer you the sort of carpet slippers and a nice hot cup of cocoa. It's not that thing. There's an interview with a practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism who's also a scholar. He's a Western scholar called Reginald Ray. He's an American Buddhist, and somebody in Sri Ratna, an order member called Vishwapani, interviewed Reginald Ray for a magazine called Dharma Life. And Reginald Ray practices, or did used to practice, I don't know what he does now, Vajrayana Buddhism. And Vishwapani was asking him whether the tantric practices that he did, whether they'd sort of worked, you know, whether they'd done what they say on the tin. And he said, yep, I can't do the American accent, he said, yep, they've worked, they've pretty much ruined my life. And Vishwapani said, what do you mean they've ruined your life? What do you mean? Do you mean your career? And he said, yep, it kind of started with my career. And that, of course, isn't very nice, is it? In a certain sense, that's not what you'd advertise on the front of the LBC. You know, come to the LBC, we can ruin your life. They wouldn't get you in the door. But if you really start to practice Buddhism, it won't, it's not that it... For me, speaking personally, it's completely enriched my life. It's transformed it. It's made it into something far more meaningful than I really could have dreamt about. I mean, maybe I did dream about having a really fulfilled life where meaning and magic and fulfillment were sort of everyday currency rather than glimpsed once in a decade or something. I feel that I live a much more meaningful life than I did. But in a conventional sense, I haven't got what I wanted. And to the degree, and it's a large degree, where I still hanker after conventional things, I'm not really living a full Buddhist life. So that's what I mean by not nice. Does that? It'll destroy. If you encounter Vajrapani, it'll destroy. Everything that we cherish about ourselves. But it does it. The Vajrapani does it. The Dharma does it in order to release and liberate something far more precious, valuable, meaningful, fulfilling, indestructible. It's as if we're frightened of our own potential and we need a good shake in order to start to realise that we're much, much more than we think we are. So when I say destroy a sense of me as a fixed and separate entity, that doesn't mean destroy... It doesn't mean that we don't exist. It doesn't mean that it destroys us literally. It means it destroys our limited view of who we are to release something far more powerful. And we've still got all of that symbolism in our modern culture, but it gets cheapened. So you've got the Marvel comics, haven't you? You've got the Incredible Hulk, who's rather similar to Vajrapani. The wrathful Vajrapani. You've got all these symbolisms because I think they're universal. But in our culture, we don't know what to do with them. We really don't know what to do with them. The Vajrayana says you can actually transform yourself, release this energy in you. Brilliant, brilliant stuff. Why wouldn't you want to do that? But it won't be pleasant, it won't be nice. So it requires courage for a start. It requires determination, focus, etc., etc. Yeah.
I'm wondering about the conceptual and/or historical relationship between the Diamond Sutra and this figure.
Yeah, there is the Diamond Sutra. Akasha Mitra is going to maybe touch on this next week. The Diamond Sutra belongs to a set of sutras, a set of teachings called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, but particularly the Diamond Sutra is called the Vajracchedika Sutra, and it is the diamond that cuts through. Right. And it's the diamond that cuts through all delusion.
Okay.
So it's trying to wake us up.
And could you sort of place these two things historically at all? I mean, and just as my understanding is that the Bodhisattva things
yes.
arose around about 10th century.
I
don't know if that's right or not, but
yeah.
there certainly is a point at which it kind of appears.
Yeah, no, it's prior to that. It's prior to that. But for now, I'm not going to go into the historical development, mainly because I want to stay with the symbolism.
Okay.
I want to stay with the symbolism. Partly because, yes, we can look at the Vajrayana in its historical development, and it did have, and does have, sort of a sort of cultural... geographical, historical place, but the Vajrayana itself wouldn't look at itself like that. It's the Vajrayana itself would look at itself in cosmic, universal terms that are trying to... The whole point of the Vajrayana is that we break through all conceptual categorization, including cultural, historical categorization. Unfortunately, what happens in the West, I mean, there's a place, so I don't mean to dismiss what you're asking, because there is a place for studying Buddhism as a historical, as a socio-historical phenomenon. There is a place for that, but if we're not careful, we think, just because we understand the history and the conceptual manifestation of Buddhism, we can think that we've got it. And the Vajrayana is the antithesis of that. It's actually saying, if you think you've got it, you haven't even started. You don't understand. You're much closer to what the Vajrayana is getting at when you realise that you don't understand, when I don't understand. When we really are naked and standing before reality, sort of trembling, thinking we don't have a clue. Yeah, that would be more like the Vajrayana, what it's getting at. And so I want to stay with that symbolic significance and see if we can start to get a feel for that. There is a place, however, for looking at it in historical, social, historical terms, but I don't want to go there just yet. Okay. Yeah?
I'm having trouble trying to imagine this destroying everything that you treasure about yourself, because I'm thinking about something that you treasure about yourself, you might also treasure about everyone else too. So, like, in a characteristic or... I don't know, I kept thinking about, like, culture or like creativity.
Yes, or beauty or love or yes. So you're quite right to ask that, because actually destroying isn't such a good word. Maybe a better word would be purifying. These flames that Vajrapani is surrounded with are said to be the flames that purify. And by purify I don't mean I mean sort of essentialize. And what it's purified of is our egotism, our self-centeredness. So when we do the metta bhavana, we're cultivating metta, but probably for most of us, certainly for me, usually there's a trace of self-centeredness, even in my metta. There's a sense of me cultivating metta. Even in our most altruistic acts, often there's a sense of me. Now that can be more or less present. What Vajrapani represents is the energy that purifies all of our acts and qualities from any sense of self-centeredness. So it makes them even more beautiful. Yeah. So it's the self-centeredness, it's the egotism that's destroyed, if you like. Not the beauty, not the potential, not the vibrancy, not the life, not the creativity. Actually, that's what's released from these flames. So you're quite right. It's destruction in a very, very particular sense. Destruction as a metaphor of everything that stands in our way to perfect liberation. Yeah? It's a very, very positive releasing, but a powerful metaphor. Yeah. So let me come on to the Vajra itself. So the Vajra has, I don't know if most of you have had a chance to look at it yet, but at its centre is this sphere. Actually, in the one that I passed around, it's slightly flattened, but it would be a sphere. And this sphere is reality in its undivided wholeness. It's symbolising... A sphere is a symbol, I guess, of wholeness, of unity. It's undivided reality, things as they really are in their essence. Out of that sphere, there are two sides to the Vajra that are emerging. Yeah? And the first thing that sort of emerges from this sphere on both sides are two stylized lotus flowers. And these lotus flowers, as they open, they're representing, they're symbolizing, as it were, the two poles in which this undivided reality manifests. One is the unenlightened samsaric pole, and the other is the enlightened nirvanic pole. In a way, they're two aspects of perceiving. But you could say that it's like they're two different realms emerging out of this undivided wholeness. The realm of unenlightened existence and the realm of the Buddhas. They emerge out of this unbroken sphere as two lotuses. And then out of the lotuses, you've got these various spokes. Yeah? But the spokes are emerging from the mouths of these sort of mysterious beings. And these mysterious beings are, they're mythical beings that are sort of, well, they're like crocodiles, actually. A bit like crocodile mouths. Although it's so stylized, you probably can't see it in the one that you've got. Crocodiles are said to be, well, they're not said to be, they're amphibious, aren't they? So they're beings of earth and water. And the Vajra is in every aspect of itself, it's trying to point to the union of opposites. So out of these mouths, you've got a series of spokes. You've got this central kind of axis which runs through. And then on the one you've got there, you've got four spokes coming out either side. Yeah? And one set of spokes represents all the enlightened wisdoms, the wisdoms of the Buddhas. Wisdom in its different facets. There's five different facets to it. And the other set of spokes represents poisons of the unenlightened mind. Poisons of the unenlightened mind. So right in the centre, the central poison of the unenlightened mind is ignorance. It's intoxication. It's spiritual ignorance. It's ignorance about our true nature and the true nature of everything. And then the next poison is the poison of aversion, of hatred, of anger, of repulsion, that pushes anything away, anything that threatens us that we don't like. And the next poison is the poison of pride, of conceit, of egotism, of thinking that I am better than anybody else. Interestingly, Buddhism says that if you think you're worse than anybody else, that's also conceit. So, because it's just inverted pride. To think that you're less than is also inverted pride. It's pride. To think that you're more than is pride. And then Buddhism comes and says, so if you think you're the same as, that's also conceit. So then that sort of demolishes our sort of well, sort of political correctness, doesn't it? Or whatever, that we're all the same. Buddhism said that's just another conceit. Nothing can be said about anything because it's ineffable. To compare, the very tendency to compare is conceited. So you've got ignorance, root ignorance, you've got aversion and hatred and anger and malice and all of that repulsive poison, that force in us. You've got conceit. Then you've got craving and passion and addiction and wanting, this insatiable wanting that seems to fuel us and fuel so much of our culture. Yeah? The insatiable desire, craving. That's another poison, one of the spokes on the Vajra. And the last one is envy, where we really just, it's this. Envy is this insidious mixture of wanting and hating. You hate somebody because you want what they have. Yeah? So it's this horrible kind of mixture. There are five poisons. There are five poisons that all unenlightened beings, me included, have. But the Vajra is brilliant because you've got this other side, which are these five spokes pointing to five wisdoms, the wisdoms of the Buddha. And what the Vajra is saying is that these poisons can be transmuted into enlightenment, into wisdom. The very energy of those poisons can be harnessed and transmuted. So this is where the Vajrayana is the Buddhism of energy. It's the Buddhism of accessing our hatred, our craving, our conceit, our ignorance, our envy, accessing all of that darker stuff that normally we're ashamed of, being really honest about it, confronting it, and then transmuting the energy that's locked up in it. Because what Vajrayana says, the Vajrayana says, is that actually it's just energy. It's always shunya. There's nothing fixed there. If you can harness it, you can transform it. So it's this alchemy again. And the Vajra is that symbol of transformation. It's transforming all our energies. So I've got time for a question or two. The obvious question would be how? How do you do that? Somebody asked me how.
How?
How? Well done. So, I mean, I don't really know. So I can give you the theory. But I can't really say that I've done it. The theory is that you... Say you're experiencing anger. Let's take anger as an example. One way of not transforming it is to vent your anger and to vent it in blame. Blame towards others or blame towards oneself and just let rip. That won't transform it. That just vents it and it causes harm to yourself and to others. Another way of not transforming it is to suppress it, to deny it, to pretend that you're a nice person that never feels angry. And that also causes harm. It will come out sooner or later, and it will come out in a weird way. So those are not routes to transformation. Transformation will involve really feeling and containing the experience of anger. Meditation helps you develop a container for it. Not just meditation, but all of Buddhist practice. But meditation, perhaps par excellence, helps you develop a container where you can feel your emotions without suppressing them or venting them. If you can acknowledge that you feel angry, but let go of the narrative of blame. Normally, when we feel angry, there's a narrative of blame, and that narrative is never helpful. Yeah, it might be true to some degree, it's just never helpful. Buddhism is not interested. If it's not helpful, it's not interested. So blame, never helpful. If you can feel the anger but let go of the narrative, and I mean feel it in the body, this is why Vajrayana is an embodied tradition. It is about transforming the energies in the body. If you can feel the anger in the body, it will feel like a fiery, burning, tight, uncomfortable sensation. Do you know what I mean? It will feel like there's a fire in your chest, in your belly, and it will be uncomfortable. If you can sit with that without any judgment, but with a kindly, metaphor attitude, yeah, and let go of any stories that are unhelpful, all stories, if you can sit in a really concentrated way with kindness towards it, what you can start to experience is that it's just energy moving. There's no problem with it. It's just energy. And then, if you can direct that energy through reflection, you also need to have some reflective capacity. So if you can start to see that there's no fixedness to this energy, that in fact it isn't you, it's not yours, it's just manifesting. If you can reflect with kindness, with concentration, and actually just confront, sit with what you're feeling, it can, well, the alchemy can happen. And that energy can be transmuted. And anger can turn into love, just like that. I've experienced it once, happening quite dramatically for me in meditation. So it's easier said than done. You need actually all of Buddhist practice to do this. Do you see what I mean? It's not going to just happen unless you can be really concentrated, really able to sit with your experience without narratives, really practicing ethics so that you're not venting and blaming. Really able to own your experience. Really able to work with metta, metta as an alchemical force and in your body. Really able to reflect on your experience in dharmic terms. If you can do all of that, and that's all what the Buddhist path is about, then you'll start to experience transformation. You start to experience, in a way, the magic that the Vajra is embodying. You start to experience a release of energy from its fixed egotistical state to something that's liberated, far more free. You start to experience what images like this, what Vajrapani is really holding. He's not out there. This is the potential that we have in our own minds, in our own hearts, in our own bodies even. You reject nothing in the Vajrayana, but you transform and transmute everything. That requires real, real discipline, not something you do overnight. Yeah, one more.
Language should you have in your head? What you should you be saying to yourself when you're trying to implement non-judgment? Because I at least find it very difficult to not judge that which has caused me anger,
yeah.
To not let it go into roller coaster mode.
Yeah, indeed. I think you can start to. I mean, you'd have to. It requires that question more time than I've got, but you could start to. In meditation, let go of any language if you're able to. But if you can't, you can start to replace the judgmental language with blame with more helpful language. Like trying to understand that whatever situation has caused you anger, that actually it's an arising of lots of different conditions. It's not that there is just one cause behind this situation. So sometimes, for example, we think that it's the other person who's causing our suffering. But when you look at what motivates them and why are they acting in the way they're acting, you can start to sometimes understand that their behaviour is also conditioned by other things. Then we start to look at ourselves, and sometimes we've acted very foolishly. It's easy then to blame ourselves, but if we look and reflect at the conditions that have been present in our lives, we can start to understand why we act in the way that we do. Yeah? That sort of reflection, I'm just giving you a quick pointer, is a sort of reflection that can start to untangle the knot of hatred and blame. Yeah? It starts to move us towards something a bit more free and with a broader perspective. But there are other ways of working. Maybe we'll have to come back to this. It's a big, big topic. But in meditation, sometimes it's useful just to see if you can, particularly if you're concentrated, let go of any story. And all you're trying to do is sit with metta.
Thank you.
Okay. So what I want to do to finish with is just to sit for a moment or two. And let's just come back to our bodies, to our real experience, our felt experience in the body. Back into the belly. see if you can let go of any narratives, even any labels about your experience. Just experience the energy. Shifting sensations in the belly. In the rest of the body. We're going to carry on looking at the Vajra. There's much more to explore in the Vajra. And next week we're going to carry on looking at that.